called installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Licensed civilian gun bearers in occupied Palestine, predominantly Jewish men, are openly encouraged by the Zionist regime to shoot to kill alleged or perceived Palestinian people. On the night of May 16th, Jewish shooters reportedly arrived in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Shafat in four cars, opened fire on Palestinian residents, and injured two, says Rella Mazali Ryder in an article titled, Israeli Gun Owners Are Licensed by Zionist Regime to Kill Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime's bombing has stopped, at least for now. But we need to talk about guns as well as bombs and neighborhoods as well as territories. Indeed, the Israeli regime's small arms policies and its war policies are directly and indirectly linked. Licensed civilian gun bearers in occupied Palestine, predominantly Jewish men, are openly encouraged by the Zionist regime to shoot to kill alleged or perceived Palestinian people. On the night of May 16th, Jewish shooters reportedly arrived in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Shafat in four cars, opened fire on Palestinian residents, and injured two. Tellingly, reports noted that the shooters were licensed gun bearers. earlier, Jewish men shot and killed 32-year-old Musa Hassuna from dozens of meters away, near his home in Lod, inside the occupied Palestine. A demand for their release from police custody, where they were held for interrogation, was tweeted the next day by the Zionist regime's public security minister, who lauded the shooters as licensed gun carriers. In recent years, the Israeli regime's policies on small arms have taken an ominous, aggressive turn. The current sharp spike in license applications is a direct result of these policies, as well as a response to the recent eruption of violence. According to data obtained by Gun Free Kitchen Tables, GFKT, a coalition of civil society organizations aiming to disarm homes and streets and to tighten gun controls, in the past 5 years, gun licensing authorities have issued more than 100,000 new civilian licenses. This trend has been strongly protested by the coalition, which has also contested it in the Zionist regime Supreme Court. New data on shootings of women in the occupied Palestine already seems to reflect the lethal results of the regime's policies. In 2020, the number of women shot dead with a licensed gun in the occupied Palestine was 2.5 times the average number of female gun victims in the preceding 4 years combined. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime police have been over and under policing Palestinian cities and towns inside the occupied Palestine for decades. They have made disproportionate numbers of often arbitrary arrests while knowingly enabling the stockpiling of unlicensed firearms. According to GFKT's research, these are mostly procured from military and other licensed sources, and they increasingly arm criminal groups. Nearly 100 Palestinian citizens were killed in 2020, mostly with guns, far outnumbering Jewish casualties in the same period, though the community forms just 20% of the population. For more than a decade, Palestinian leaders have been pleading with the Israeli regime's officials to stem the flow of arms into their communities. The regime has done nothing. No ministers will be demanding the release of the detained Palestinians, certainly not the public security minister who is in charge of the police. Police will not duplicate the kind of support they provide for attacks by the right-wing groups whom they give full access to Palestinian neighborhoods without intervening. During 1 week of the unrest in May, the Zionist regime police reportedly arrested 850 Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine compared with 150 Jews. At the same time, there are great attention-grabbing ploys to sidestep the failing governance of those in power. This is precisely the same algorithm that has yielded the Zionist regime's war policies. This fake regime appears to have zero interest in reducing violence or preserving lives, especially not Palestinian lives. Supremacy and expansion, and above all, clinging to power, Trump lives and blocks any possible moves towards negotiated political solutions. The only solutions envisioned are force, bombs, and guns. This is why the fake regime of Israel is fast unraveling.
get people.
U.S. veterans' food insecurity.
Food insecurity is a dark reality facing many people across the United States, including a portion of war veterans, active duty members, and military families. They had been assigned to protect and serve their country, but many are now left with barely enough to eat.
Judge, I have something I'd like to bring to your attention, and I know you already know this, but I'm driving around the city every day, and I don't know what to do about it. I will think about it, but there's people in every corner with their cups and stuff, and it just breaks me up. You know, some of them are very, very, very distraught. You know, there's another veteran, a fellow brother of mine, is in a wheelchair, one leg, right here on the service road. Mm-hmm. I always stop and give him $10. So, you know, 5-10 years ago, you'd see one or two of them, but now they're at every intersection.
Welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi, and in this episode, we will delve into the critical issue of food insecurity among war veterans and military families in the United States. Stay with us.
But we begin today with the rather shameful and sad story of homeless and hungry veterans. Americans, they're not surprised to know that 500,000 people are homeless in America. We see them every day on our streets, many living there. But it's estimated that as many as 10% or even more are veterans, men and women who risk their lives serving their nation. And many more have some shelter, but they're hungry. How did this happen to the people who risk their lives to serve this country?
Since the pandemic hit, a recent study found almost 40% of active duty families have been in need of food support. Some surveys show that a significant portion of junior enlisted families have talked about food insecurity this year, which means even the newcomers are concerned about putting food on the table.
The United States led the ranking of countries with the highest military spending in 2020. With $778 billion dedicated to the military. But it still cannot handle food and shelter for a significant percentage of its service members. Our first guest in this episode is Dr. Rick Stagenberg, retired Veterans Affairs psychiatrist, who is now a social and political commentator and an activist for peace and universal healthcare in the United States. Welcome, Dr. Stagenberg. First of all, why are so many American war veterans food insecure?
That's a difficult question. Part of the reason is because a lot of them are traumatized by the war and they have difficulty caring for themselves. They can't be around people. They can't hold employment. And a lot of them are concerned about going to the Veterans Administration, which is the American healthcare system for veterans. And of course, if they're homeless, they're in the same boat as other homeless Americans, of which there are millions. It's random, practically, whether or not they can get services, depending on where they live. It's up to the local communities for the most part.
Many thanks for your insight.
Estimates of food insecurity vary widely, ranging from 6 to 24%. Comparing rates of food insecurity among households with veterans of the U.S. Armed Forces and non-veteran households sheds light on how the U.S. veterans are holding.
Last year, we kicked off a national food drive campaign to feed hungry veterans and military families. In 2011, we signed up to hire 1,000 veterans or military spouses, and we've hired almost 5,000 since that time. We're here to help.
Thank you so much for your service.
I was at the Battle of Okinawa when I was 18 years old.
I was in special operations for 10 years. I did a combination of 26 years as an IT.
Veterans are cheered and saluted, but many are reportedly food insecure. According to the Department of Veteran Affairs, food insecurity among veterans is nearly twice that of the U.S. general population. We're now joined by Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer from San Francisco. Welcome to the program, sir.
My pleasure.
What does food insecurity among veterans indicate about how the U.S. military is handled?
Well, it indicates the U.S. military is very, very needing of real leaders and real senior officers who are able to care for the men in traditional leadership parental roles. That has always been the role of an officer over his men, is to care for them in a sense of love and discipline. And it also shows us that the military lack of leadership is also matched with a lack of medical care and understanding of the soldiers and what they go through. Instead of prescribing rehabilitative community activities or counseling or things that can be very, very constructive.
Some very interesting points there. Many thanks for your insight.
There is also the problem of hunger among U.S.'s newest veterans, which demands close attention. Upon returning home, many of the veterans face unemployment as well as difficulties in reintegrating with their families and into the community.
What exactly happened to you?
I got relieved from the military due to Obama sequestration. So they're reducing forces, so they tackled the higher-ranking officers and NCOs to early retirement, but I was not able to retire at that time because I was shy, 2 years shy for full retirement. So they just took me off my orders and placed me on unemployability. And at that point,
you were like, "What do I do?"
Know what I do exactly, sir.
Kind of caught you off guard.
Pretty much, sir.
So where did you wind up?
Wind up not having a job, losing everything, and pretty much almost in the street.
Consistent ability to access sufficient food for a healthful lifestyle is a serious challenge facing the veterans and their families. The prevalence of food insecurity reported across the United States has prompted calls on authorities to take action.
Well, unfortunately, I'm afraid most of them don't realize that last point. They don't realize that they were really serving the interests of the rich and these corporate interests that basically control the government. They don't know why they went to war. They know it was horrible. A lot of them think it was a mistake because they didn't see anything good happening. But somehow they have to justify to themselves why they put themselves through all that. And so a lot of them, not all of them, don't really want to look at the fact that they were used and thrown away.
Food insecurity is the lack of access to a sufficient quantity of affordable and nutritious food. Relying on a single income makes it difficult for military families to get by, as the spouses of the military personnel cannot easily find jobs because they move around based on their spouse's services.
My name is Tom Stiggins, and I'm a veteran of Iraq. I don't have to tell you that folks in the military are proud of what we've done. We're proud of our country. We're proud of our service. We're proud of ourselves. Unfortunately, that pride often masks the pain that we feel when we get back. Veterans have a higher unemployment rate and a higher rate of homelessness than many other groups in our population. And so as you show support for veterans on this upcoming Veterans Day, I ask you to do one small thing. Do one small thing. One small thing. Give a tiny bit of money, a tiny bit of your time to help veterans out.
Therefore, paying for personal necessities, including food, has become a challenge. Food insecurity also has been associated with increased healthcare costs, as families have to rely on calorie-dense and nutrient-poor junk foods, which are less expensive and more readily available.
As I said, the VA does a pretty good job for what they do. They would do a much better job if they were properly funded. but in terms of other aspects, let me just tell you that one veteran I worked with, and this is a World War II veteran, said that I didn't risk my life for this kind of country. He's old enough to see how the United States has deteriorated. His power has been transferred more and more from the people to these corporate fat cats in Wall Street, the ones who profit from war. Fortunately, there are some veterans who do see this. a lot of them, I wish there were more of them, become Veterans for Peace, which is an international organization that I'm proud to be a member of.
Those who were supposed to provide security for the nation are themselves food insecure. Men and women of the military are facing a different battle, getting enough to eat. There are higher rates of food insecurity among certain groups of veterans, including Black and Latino.
They sent me to Chulai, and I ended up in 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, as a platoon commander for Kilo Company.
I'm a retired Army major. I went to Vietnam as an enlisted woman. I was 19.
You're 26 years old, and, you know, and you're enjoying life to the hilt, you know. And they're locked up for 8.5 years, I would say, yeah, it's a hell of a maturing process.
For many active duty military families, food assistance programs are a lifeline. For many Americans, the Federal Assistance Program, or SNAP, is a lifeline, but it is not an easy option for most military families. Many people and organizations join forces to raise money to alleviate critical food insecurities. So, has the U.S. government done enough?
Well, I foresee the Biden policies only eroding and deteriorating both the military's effectiveness as a unit and also degrading and deteriorating the individual minds and souls and families and individual personalities of the soldiers. So you'll also have a lot more soldiers going on to welfare and homeless and in needing of government services, because the Biden policies have no interest in the emotional healing and well-being of the individual.
Some activists and lawmakers are hoping to change that. The Biden administration has been pushing for an increase in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP benefits, amid the growing numbers of food insecure Americans.
There was, back in the 1990s, a moment when it was clear that military families were beginning to apply for food stamps, what we now call SNAP. And there was a concern about the optics of this. So in their infinite wisdom, the military and Congress created a program that was designed to provide a supplemental subsistence allowance. And that was almost identical to the SNAP program, but only available to military.
Formerly known as the Food Stamp Program, SNAP is the largest federal food assistance program to provide low-income Americans with cash benefits to purchase food. It is also supposed to offer reductions in healthcare costs. Nearly 60% of eligible veterans are not enrolled in the program that supports fewer than 1.4 million veterans only.
They've been trying to privatize the VA. In other words, to have private providers, doctors and other healthcare providers, do the sort of things that the VA can do for itself. Now, sometimes we have to send people, or the VA has to send people to private providers because they don't offer that service in an area. That's perfectly reasonable. But the Veterans Administration is short about 50,000 employees right now, and that's unacceptable. One of the main reasons is the administrations are not paying enough money to doctors. The Health Administration, VHA, is not paying enough money to doctors and other health professionals to be competitive with these private providers.
Since the pandemic, the need for food has grown while cash donations have dried up since other people struggle. Food insecurity has skyrocketed through the pandemic for many Americans, but it has been an issue long before the novel coronavirus for many military families.
A lot of people came to the pantry, got what they needed, and then maybe they came back one more time, but then they were gone. COVID, we're seeing the same people week after week, month after month. Prior to the pandemic, in San Diego, for example, we were serving 400 families a month.
Active duty military families, 400.
Post-pandemic, we had to shift to 400 a week.
Wow. So even before this unbelievable last year, there was a need.
a real need. What we hear from families is the issue is really childcare and spouse employment, and the two are absolutely inextricably intertwined.
COVID-19 has indeed worsened the situation in the low-income families generally. Having access to adequate nutrition needs to be a top priority for the whole nation, as well as the more vulnerable military families. So who is responsible for this situation?
Well, I'm not sure that the military would be responsible for taking care of the veterans. That's not exactly it. It's the Veterans Administration that does. But as I said, that's one service that they're not mandated to take care of. So as far as the military, the main problem is that that our veterans are being exposed to conditions which predispose them to PTSD, and as I said, being unable to care for themselves properly. So in that sense, the military is certainly responsible, and of course even more so the political leaders.
Advocates have vowed to keep pressure on policymakers with a goal of reducing hunger in the communities amid the coronavirus pandemic. The normally hidden and underreported issue of food insecurity suddenly became very visible last year when lines at food shelves and meal pickup sites around the country became much longer.
Well, that was a total surprise. Lord have mercy. He said, I got this for you. He said, that's $100 on that card, right? Oh, Jesus, I mean.
Not knowing where your next meal is going to come from is not a good feeling. And then the fact that a veteran, someone that served our country, has to go through something like that, along with a lot of other issues that he's overcoming and a lot of other barriers, it makes you want to do something.
Food insecure veterans tend to be younger, not married, and living in households with more children. Oftentimes, they earn lower incomes and have lower final military pay grade. Many of the food insecure veterans often use tobacco, more frequently binge drink, and sleep less.
So the veterans that discover this are very, very traumatized and emotionally frustrated, and that compounds the difficulty of day-to-day operations and life management. It often deteriorates their marriages, their relationships with their wives and children. That then advances them into chemical dependencies. You often have veterans being prescribed mental medications, hallucinatory medications, sleep medications to cope with some of these stresses. And those medications only amplify the stresses and make them much more difficult. So now you have a chemical dependency, broken relationships, a fractured identity, all because of the artificial wars.
Food insecurity among veterans often stems from mental health issues that they endure. U.S. veterans have had experiences that most Americans cannot even imagine, but they still have to worry about putting food on the dinner table.
So a lot of the causes are a livable wage coming out of the service, transferable skills that can get you that livable wage. Again, an understanding from the employers on how to deal with people who are coming directly out of combat zones and seeing some horrific things, and then being able to work in those environments. Again, you can't scream and yell at a person if they're late for work when they've seen those conditions.
Adapting back to civilian life when they return from overseas has proven troublesome for many, particularly for those returning from war zones such as Afghanistan, Iraq, or Vietnam. American soldiers coming back from war zones often experience depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, also known as PTSD, an anxiety disorder that follows experiencing a traumatic event.
Well, the reason so many veterans are food insecure are a combination of forces. Number one, the trauma of warfare when they come back has a very corrosive effect on their ability to manage their own lives. It has a very damaging, corrosive effect on their identity. Many of them come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, guilt. That is amplified when they begin to discover that the war in Iraq and Afghanistan were largely artificial, contrived, fake, and based on false evidence for political motives.
There are, meanwhile, those who cite progress made in addressing veteran food insecurity in America made by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But many believe that the progress has been extremely slow when the severity of the problem is taken into account.
Greatest among these responsibilities is to ensure that our veteran and military families have a dignified quality of life that honors their sacrifices. But all too often, despite the efforts of our government, it falls to organizations like Feeding San Diego and Feeding America to close this significant gap between what our heroes have and what they need to provide for their families. I am proud of my organization, but I take no pride in the fact that our country stations people in San Diego without paying them enough to live in San Diego. And I take no pride in seeing ever larger numbers of veterans lining up at our Feeding Heroes food pantries every year. And the good news is that Feeding San Diego has innovative food rescue approaches.
With Congress and federal agencies failing to take due action to prioritize the critical issue, it could only get worse and increasingly more difficult to resolve. There are also reports showing that the available support for veterans is tinged with stigma and shame, sometimes even involving a complicated application process.
The medical military community prescribes medications, drugs, and other things to essentially numb the mind and make it less susceptible to nervous disorders. But ultimately, that is like filling a balloon with waste products, feces, and other poisonous substances, that eventually the balloon explodes and all of that matter and all that poison and toxicity and anger and frustration pours out, and it sometimes causes severe violence and suicide and other traumas. So it shows me that the military is really ill-prepared and unwilling to listen to legitimately help heal and rehabilitate the mental frustrations, the emotional frustrations, and the spiritual emptiness that many soldiers experience when they return from a combat theater.
Food insecurity is an important public health issue for U.S. veterans dealing with service-incurred health issues and socioeconomic challenges. The Pentagon is reportedly working to track the problem, in part by adding a question about food insecurity on a survey it will send to active duty spouses this summer.
I had been a high school teacher for a time. I couldn't take teaching with me when we moved up to Washington State because I wasn't certified to teach there. We also had no family in the area, so we didn't have any affordable childcare options.
The Navy income wasn't enough.
A lot of people don't realize is that when you are an enlisted service member, meaning sort of those lower ranking positions, it's often not really enough. It was really embarrassing. People constantly, when they find out that you served or that your partner served, they like to thank you for your service, and it really felt shameful. It was like I just didn't want anyone to know that that was our reality.
The issue of food insecurity is a complex one, making many in the United States wonder why so many men and women who have served the country should struggle with hunger. Yet the problem remains a prevalent one, cutting across gender, age, and even housing status. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Please tune in again next week when we come back with another episode of We the People.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leaders' speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
The last point that I would like to raise is the concerns that I have about the issue of slandering during the time of elections in our country. Unfortunately, it is some time now that it has become common. I am really concerned about the orientations that are adopted here and there. This does not mean that the people who do this are many. In fact, there are a few people who do this. But even the activities of those few people damage the environment of society. This is like a gathering of 1-2,000 people in a place. 5-6 individuals among this group of people have a cold and they always cough. This damages the environment of the gathering. Society too is really like this gathering. Unfortunately, as soon as the season of elections arrives, some people with different motives begin their slandering. Some people with political motives and some even with religious motives slander political, religious, and revolutionary personalities and honorable ulama and seminarians in Islamic seminaries. What is this? This is not acceptable either from the viewpoint of Sharia or from the viewpoint of reason. Neither Sharia nor reason accept this. Someone is really dissatisfied with the orientation that some individuals has, the way to express it is not to slander and insult them. The way to do this is not to mention the names of such and such people. The way to do it is to clarify and illustrate. From the beginning, the movement of the revolution was based on clarification. From the beginning, certain truths were clarified. When one defines light, then darkness will be defined on its own. It is all right to define and specify darkness, but there is no logic behind mentioning the names of individuals and slandering honorable and respectable personalities. If the goal of some people is to blind and destroy a deviant line and orientation, this is not the way. Such behavior will not fulfill the purpose. And it is clear what the viewpoint of Sharia is in this regard.
Thank you.
this tree.
In parallel with the continuous Israeli attacks in the occupied city of Al-Quds and further attempts by members of religious Zionist extremists to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Al-Qassam Brigade, the military wing of Hamas, warned in a message to the leaders of the occupation and its settlers of the consequences of such bigotry. Meanwhile, Benjamin Netanyahu incurred the biggest loss in his political history, which will be enough to end the man's 12 continuous years as prime minister. Thus, the winds of change are gusting within the Zionist regime after a cycle of early elections that lasted the internal crisis for nearly 2.5 years. These changes, however, will not touch the apartheid policies, not only because the new prime minister is one of the most prominent faces of the extreme right, but also because this new governmental coalition will have to keep pace with settler opinion, for which the right wing has become part of its identity. The obstacles to forming the new Israeli government fell one after the other, where the new government scored the needed confidence votes on Sunday. The government of Yamina party leader Naftali Bennett was born, while Benjamin Netanyahu headed to the opposition seats in the Knesset to fight for his political and personal fate within his party and in court, which he worked hard to bypass, yet eventually failed. However, as the new government won confidence, Netanyahu is expected to face a different reality that may bring down his long-term hopes, even if he succeeds in deterring the rebellion against him within his own party or bypassing his trial. As part of the new coalition's understandings, it was agreed to move forward with amending the basic law of the Knesset with the aim of preventing Netanyahu from running in the upcoming elections. Meanwhile, perhaps one of the most important repercussions of the Palestinian Intifada was the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds, which threw a ball of flame into the lap of Fatah movement in the occupied territories. Because of Mahmoud Abbas's leadership, the movement failed to keep pace with the Intifada and the war as it befits it, knowing that many members of Fatah have contributed by their own initiative to the uprisings in the West Bank. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. There is no doubt that the latest round of confrontation witnessed in occupied Palestine, which was expressed by both stones and missiles, was linked to the acceleration of the Zionist ethnic cleansing process in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in particular. However, a new catalyst that is expected to bring about new challenges for the Israeli entity is the dismissal of Benjamin Netanyahu's regime, which is heading towards incurring the biggest loss in its political history. A loss that will not be limited to Netanyahu facing jail time, but may also extend to the leadership of the Likud party and perhaps to its future in the entire Israeli arena. To discuss this issue with us from the West Bank is Dr. Saad Nimr, academic at Beer Zeit University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nimr. Now, the occupation's Knesset on Sunday approved a new right, Naftali Bennett, as prime minister, and the new cabinet was sworn in a wave of anger and chaos inside the Knesset. What happened on Sunday inside that Knesset was definitely unprecedented, where Netanyahu gave a firing speech against Bennett, and Bennett was trying to defend himself, and Netanyahu was expecting that this government will fail, and it will fail soon. Will Bennett be able to overcome this internal Zionist challenges that Netanyahu put forward, basically on Bennett's first day?
It's quite clear that Netanyahu was trying as much as he could to make this government fail. He couldn't by the end of the day, but he tried all the way till even we thought that at some time he might do some crazy thing even in the West Bank or in Gaza in order to sabotage the voting over this government. However, he tried, but he failed because he knew that it's either a seat, either the prime minister seat in the Israeli government or a seat in the prison. And that's what he's going to go to anyway, to a seat in the prison. Now, he tried to sabotage, as I said, the government of Bennett, but it didn't work. And narrowly, Bennett managed to get the vote on the government, though there is a coalition of 8 parties, or let me say 7, and the support of the Arab group to support government, but still it is a very narrow government. Now the challenges are huge in front of this government. First of all, the challenge of continuing for more than 2 months at least. Mm-hmm. The problem is with this government, from the very beginning, Bennett and Lapid, Saab and Gantz and the Likud party, they knew that there is no chemistry between all of them. But the whole problem was that we need this government only to bring Netanyahu down, and that's mm-hmm. what they did. Now, since it is very narrow, it's only 61 votes in the Knesset, means that in any time Netanyahu managed in the coming few weeks to convince even one or two of the people who are supporting this government to back up and to not to vote for them in any next voting for confidence, definitely this government will fail. And in this case, Israel is going for the fifth election within 2 years. The whole idea was for this coalition is to, as I said, to fail Netanyahu and to bring him down from the prime minister position. Now,
but
the other thing
but is Dr. Nimmer, we did see that Israel is entering a new phase after a ruling for a long time was confined only to Benjamin Netanyahu. As you are saying, you're saying that this coalition had one goal and is to bring Netanyahu out of the regime. But the change of prime minister is the most important thing at this stage in Zionist politics. However, does the fall of Netanyahu mean the fall of Israeli right-wing Zionists?
No, not really, because, you know, in the last four elections, what was going on that the right wing was competing with the right wing. So both of them are, you know, right wing. Remember that Bennett was member of the Likud with Netanyahu, and he split it and he formed his own coalition. Now, the whole thing is that there will be no difference in the politics generally. We can see that from the last Sunday speeches by Netanyahu and by Bennett. Bennett said quite clearly that we are committed to the settlements. We are going to go ahead with the plans for the settlements. We are not going to let Iran go ahead with the nuclear weapon from his point of view. And as well, we are going to keep a very close monitoring of sea area, which is the area in the West Bank, consists of around 60% of the West Bank, which Israel is trying to annex it to Israel officially. So in terms of politics, for the Palestinians at least, Bennett-Lapid government have no difference whatsoever from the one of Netanyahu. The only difference is maybe there will be some problems within the government if he announces settlements in a very clear way, because in this case, we believe that maybe Meretz, which consider itself a Zionist left, and maybe the Labour Party would object to that, and that will bring the government back again to a failure in the coming few weeks or maximum 2 months time. Because of that, but there will be no difference in the politics, and there is no change in the Israeli politics in general after this government. Both governments, the Netanyahu one and this new one, are going on the same track. They are both two faces for the same coin. So it's it has nothing to do with the Palestinians. Even the Americans, when they are trying to congratulate Bennett for his government, now they will try to say, okay, give it time, and we will see how it's going to do its conduct in the politics, and hoping that we can bring back the Palestinians and Israeli together into negotiations. Bennett made it very clear that he's not going to negotiate. He's make it very clear that he's not going to give anything to the Palestinians, nor he would allow a Palestinian state, exactly in the same lines of Netanyahu. So I don't think that this government will make any change for the overall picture in the area.
Dr. Saad, the wind of change are creating new challenges for the Israeli entity, whether internally where this crisis has been going on for the past 2.5 years, or whether on the Palestinian scene, because a new challenge has emerged that Netanyahu maybe never faced or faced with a minimal effect, but Bennett is now going to face a new wave of Palestinian revolution against the occupation. How do you think he will be able to handle the harmony between the resistance in Gaza and also the resistance revived by the youth of Palestine in Al-Quds, in West Bank, in the 1948 territories?
Well, we should not wait very long anyway. Tomorrow it will be the first examination in that government and on what's going on, because the Israeli will be postponed earlier the march, the flag march for the settlers inside
which was
Jerusalem.
Supposed to happen Tuesday, June 15.
Yes, when they postpone it now, Netanyahu in the last few days, he gave orders for this march to go ahead in an attempt also to sabotage the government of Bennett. Now, Bennett had to face tomorrow what was going on. The Palestinians are very alerted. They are very aware of what's going on. So we expect tomorrow there will be a clashes in Jerusalem, and it will be kind of really hard one. At the same time, most expectedly that in all the other cities and areas in the West Bank, there will be also clashes on the hotspots near the towns and the cities around the West Bank. So to what extent that would encourage Hamas to also participate, I don't know till this moment, but maybe we will we'll wait and see. But I think it's a little bit far to think of it as something possible now. But generally speaking, there will be, yes, a kind of a confrontation coming soon.
This brings about a very important notion that brings about to the Palestinian scene is a shift in the balance of power, the power of initiative, which is benefiting the Palestinian natives against the Zionist occupation. But in all of this scene, in 1 minute, do you think that the Oslo Agreement is still viable, it's still a reality inside of Palestine?
It depends on who's looking at it. From our point of view as people, Palestinian people in general, and the Palestinian resistance, definitely Oslo became the two-state solution is two-state illusion, and Oslo is dead. That's it. No more thinking even of it or going back to it in any way. Maybe the Palestinian Authority is backed by the Europeans, the Americans. They are still talking about, you know, two-state solution and Oslo agreement in a way or another, because they have no other alternative to that. If the European, for instance, said that the two-state solution failed, so what's next? What's the next step? What is the alternative? They have no alternative, and they don't want to think about, you know, one state or the idea that this colonial project called Israel, as a colonial, racist, apartheid regime, should be confronted not only by the Palestinians, but also by all the Arab, Islamic, as well as the international community.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Saad Nimr, academic at Birzeit University, talking to us about the shift of power inside of Palestine towards the Palestinian natives. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the developments inside of Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Parallel to the Omani delegation continuing its talks in Sana'a for the second week in a row, there were persistent American attempts to push towards the legalization of the presence of foreign forces in Yemeni lands and waters, and to even postpone talking about this presence indefinitely. This new condition angered Sana'a and embarrassed the Omanis. The efforts of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to limit the talks to what falls under Ansarullah's control completely contradicts the principles of the resistance movement, which considers that engaging in any international endeavors that surpasses Yemeni independence is an illegal matter and unacceptable to be placed under negotiations. More in this following report.
As he prepared for departure from Sana'a with a delegation of the office of the Sultan of Oman on Friday, the spokesman of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement and the head of its negotiation delegation Mohammed Abdel Salam, announced that the Omanis have been presented with the possible vision for ending the aggression and lifting the siege imposed on Yemen, beginning with securing the humanitarian operation. Abdel Salam pointed out that the meetings of the Omani delegation included the leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, head of the Supreme Political Council, the General Staff, the Coordination and Redeployment Committee in Hodeidah, and social and political figures from Ma'rib Governorate. Meanwhile, the Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi arrived on Thursday in the Saudi capital Riyadh, bearing a written message from Sultan Haytham bin Tariq to King Salman. The message appears to be related to the discussions held by the Omani royal delegation in Sana'a over a period of 5 days, whose indications suggested that a significant breakthrough has been achieved in the humanitarian file, perhaps paving the way for moving to other more complicated political files. Parallel to the Omani delegation's talks in Sana'a last week, there were persistent American attempts to push towards the legalization of the presence of foreign occupation forces in Yemeni lands and waters, and to postpone talking about this presence indefinitely, a new condition that angered Sana'a and embarrassed the Omanis. The Biden administration and Saudi Arabia attempted to limit the peace talks to confine the areas under Ansarullah's control, as the latter rejected these attempts since it completely contradicts the principles of the movement, which considers that engaging in any international endeavors that go beyond the ceiling of the Yemeni independence and sovereignty is an illegal matter. This was confirmed by the Supreme Political Council in Sana'a during its regular meeting last week, where it stressed that lifting the siege, stopping the aggression by air, land, and sea, ending the occupation, the exit of foreign forces, and non-interference in the internal affairs of Yemen are basic principles that cannot be deviated from in any future discussions.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Laith, now, we did see that the Omani foreign minister flew last week to Riyadh, and he had a written message from the Sultan of Oman, Sultan Haytham bin Tariq, to King Salman. And supposedly this message suggested a significant breakthrough that has been achieved concerning the Yemeni humanitarian condition. Do you think that this might be a way to pave the route for maybe going into political discussions that have been just stuck in stalemate since March 2015?
Unfortunately, I don't think so, and specifically because if you look at what the United States is attempting to do, which is to calm down as many conflicts that it's involved in and its vessels are involved in, so it can concentrate on war with China or Russia. The reality is the United States doesn't want to have peace with Iran, doesn't want to have peace with Syria or Yemen, just like apartheid Israel doesn't want to have peace with the Palestinian people. They want to delay the confrontation, waste time on the resistance axis, pulling them into negotiations that are endless, as they did with the Palestinians for 30 years, while they concentrate on a more pressing confrontation points for them, like China and Russia. So it is in the interest of the resistance as a whole, including in Yemen, not to be pulled into this ridiculous scheme of negotiating forever.
Well, Laith, Ansarullah are still very doubtful concerning these talks, especially in the light of the continued American evasion, which recently took the form of an attempt to try and remove the issue of even talking about foreign occupation forces holding grounds inside of Yemen. They won't even, the Ansarullah not even talk about this matter. By the way, this is one of Ansarullah's big no-nos. They would never, and I mean never, accept such a condition. In that event, how do you think Saudi Arabia will react? Because we know that the Yemeni resistance will just stand its ground.
Well, look, the Saudis and the Americans behind them, as I said just before, they want to delay the confrontation, waste some time on the resistance axis. And obviously the leadership of the resistance in Yemen, Ansarullah, are smart enough after, living through this